alternative route starts from India across United Arab Emirates. And hey, United Arab Emirates in all, conspiracies here, in its presence is unprecedented by any other country, as if it was planned to play this role. So it starts from India to United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and then through, it was meant to be the Israeli port, but now it's coming from Gaza to Cyprus to Europe. And this plan was meant to encounter the Nord Stream 1 and Nord Stream 2, the Russian gas. And that's why I think President Putin has warned against a possible of eruption of World War III, based on what's happening on Ukraine, and now to add to it what's going on in Gaza, and the scale of the attack, of the aggression, is also unprecedented. It's it's like World War III that we are living in Gaza area, in at 365 square kilometers, and with 2.3 million people being squeezed in, siege, blockaded for 17 years, and now exterminated. So this whole thing makes a sense that the, geopolitical strategy for the U.S.
All
is
right.
To
and on that note, so sorry to interrupt you, Amal, but we are out of time. I appreciate both of you being with me, Amal Wahdan, human rights activist out of Ramallah, and Ali Salam, editor-in-chief of Basira Press out of Tehran. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashmi signing up for myself and other group right here in Tehran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of the grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every ear. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
The headlines: Israeli occupation forces attack aid seekers in northern Gaza again, killing at least 30 of them as the overall death toll from the U.S.-Israeli genocide war tops 31,800. The Hamas leader accuses Israel of sabotaging ceasefire talks by deliberately targeting police officers and government officials in Gaza. And also in our headlines, Iran's leader congratulates the nation on the Persian New Year, naming it a surge in production through people's participation. Hello and welcome, everybody. The death toll in the Gaza Strip continues to grow as Israel carries out more bombings in the besieged territory. The health ministry in Gaza says Israeli forces killed nearly 100 people and injured over 140 others. In a day of attacks, at least 30 civilians were killed when regime forces bombed a gathering of popular committees formed to secure the transfer of aid from the Kuwait roundabout to Gaza City. Some 15 people were also killed by an Israeli airstrike targeting a house in the Al-Nusayrat refugee camp in central Gaza. Rescue operations are ongoing to recover victims trapped under the rubble of the three-story building. The death toll from the U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza since October the 7th has risen above 31,800, while nearly 74,000 have also been injured. Joining us now from Deir al-Bala in central Gaza, we have our very own Moti Abu Mosape, who's joining us with more updates as the Israeli genocidal onslaught on Gaza continues. Moti, what do you have to share with us?
Yes, actually, the Israeli genocide is still persistent in all areas of Gaza Strip, with more airstrikes and more bloodshed of the Palestinian civilians. And let's begin from the central area of Gaza Strip, where as the Israeli occupation forces committed an appalling massacre over the last night against the Palestinian civilians, particularly in Al-Nusayrat refugee camp. At least 27 Palestinian civilians, mostly women and children, were massacred. after the Israeli warplanes destroyed their residential building in the center of Al-Nusayrat refugee camp. It is another appalling massacre. And at the same time, the Israeli occupation forces also renewed their airstrikes against Al-Burij refugee camp. At least 7 Palestinian civilians were massacred as well. Over that attack, continuous Israeli airstrikes are still hitting the central area of Gaza Strip. In the meantime, the Israeli artillery also maintained its strikes and shelling against the residential areas in the eastern part of Deir el-Balah city. When it comes to Gaza city, the current situation is still catastrophic at all levels. As you have mentioned, the Israeli occupation forces committed an alarming massacre against the popular committees which were formed by the members of the big families and tribes in Gaza City in order to facilitate and safeguard the delivery of the humanitarian aid to the people in Gaza City and the northern part of Gaza Strip. The Israeli warplanes mercilessly attacked them, claiming the lives of at least 30 Palestinian civilians in that attack. In the meantime, the plural Israeli aggression is still continuous against the Ashifa Square. The Israeli tanks are still firing their shells against the residential buildings, while the Israeli airstrikes are still continued relentlessly against those areas. More Palestinian residential buildings were destroyed over the last night, while the Israeli tanks also maintained their gunfire towards the Palestinian residential areas. The current situation is hyper-hazardous for the Palestinian civilians who are still existed and still located inside Gaza City, as the Israeli occupation forces cement their grip against the Palestinian people. As you know, more Palestinian civilians were forcibly expelled from their residential areas and squares inside Gaza City, and they moved to the central area of Gaza Strip under the demands of the Israeli occupation forces that the central area of Gaza Strip is safe, while at the same time, the Israeli airstrikes are still continued here in the central area of Gaza Strip, as you can see. And on the other hand, the Palestinian resistance maintained its counterattacks against the Israeli tanks in Gaza City. At least 8 Israeli tanks were hit by the Al-Qassam brigades and Saray al-Quds and the surrounding areas of the Ashifa medical complex. We are talking about continuous and fierce clashes erupted between the Palestinian resistance and the Israeli occupation forces, particularly on those areas. So this is the current situation so far.
All right, thanks a lot. Moti Abu Musabe joining us from Deir el-Balah in central Gaza. Moving on, the Hamas political bureau chief says Israel is sabotaging ceasefire talks following the deadly raid on Gaza's largest hospital, Ashifa, which killed dozens of Palestinians. Ismail Haniyeh says the attack proves Israel's intent to obstruct medical efforts to save Palestinian lives. He said Israel also seeks to sow chaos and perpetuate violence among Palestinians by targeting police officers and government officials in Gaza. Haniyeh, however, stressed that Israel will fail to achieve its criminal plans. He vowed that during ceasefire talks, Hamas would remain committed to the rights of the Palestinian people. Negotiations for a Gaza ceasefire are underway in Doha, with Qatari mediators saying a counterproposal could soon be presented to Hamas. Israel has laid a siege to Al-Shifa Hospital for 3 days now, abducting scores of Palestinians. Elsewhere, the Canadian government has decided to stop exporting weapons to Israel following a motion that was ratified by the House of Commons. The foreign minister announced that Ottawa will no longer allow weapon exports to Israel. That came after lawmakers endorsed a wide-ranging package that also called for a halt to weapon shipment. Melanie Joly emphasized that although the parliamentary measure is non-binding, the Canadian government has heeded the call to stop arming Israel. The move has angered the Israeli regime. Foreign Minister Israel Katz denounced the Canadian decision, claiming, quote, "history will judge." Canada's House of Commons approved the halt in weapons sales to Israel on Monday following a heated debate.
"Starvation of children in Gaza as a weapon of war. Human rights groups have spoken out against targeting of journalists, civilians, hospitals, aid workers. And the UN has called out for Canada for complicity in this because we provide the military weapons to Israel. Last night, Parliament called for an end to military aid to Netanyahu's government. And yet numerous military supply deals are still in the works. So will the Minister respect Parliament and tell us whether or not deals like the guns from Colt and Kitchener and armed vehicles from Rochelle and Brampton will be sent to Israel, yes or no?
Canada had previously paused issuing military export permits to Israel amid the public outcry, but said that it was still assessing applications on a case-by-case basis. But the issue remained at the heart of controversy as lawmakers and rights activists were demanding a complete ban on weapons to Israel. A Canadian pro-Palestine advocacy group has called the parliamentary motion a small step forward for ending the country's complicity in Israel's genocidal war on Gaza. Canada has witnessed several mass anti-Israel rallies with demonstrators calling on the government to stop supporting the Tel Aviv regime. Well, the Islamic Resistance in Iraq says it has conducted fresh attacks against Israeli positions in solidarity with Palestinian people in the Gaza Strip. In its latest operation, the resistance group attacked Israel's Ben Gurion airport with drones. This is the second strike by the Iraqi resistance on this airport in less than 2 weeks. The group said the attack is part of the second phase of operations in support of the Palestinians in Gaza and in response to the Israeli massacres against innocent civilians. In recent months, the Islamic Resistance in Iraq has carried out a series of attacks against Israel's positions in the occupied territories and elsewhere. It has also attacked U.S. military bases in Iraq and neighboring Syria in retaliation for Washington's support for the Israeli genocide in Gaza. The Israeli military has confirmed that a missile fired from Yemen hit the vicinity of Eilat port in the occupied Palestinian territories. A cruise missile was launched on Monday from the Yemen army-controlled water in the Red Sea. That was the first Yemeni missile that successfully hit the Israeli target. The regime's Iron Dome and Arrow missile defense systems also failed to intercept the rocket. There is still no report of casualties or damage, as the military claims the missile fell in an unpopulated area. Eilat port has already been struggling financially amid Yemen's operations against Israeli or Israeli-bound ships in the Red Sea. The Yemeni armed forces have pledged that they would keep targeting those vessels unless the regime stops its bloodshed of Palestinians and ends its siege on Gaza. Well, Israeli raids on the occupied West Bank have become almost daily occurrences over the past several months. The regime's troops abducted several people after conducting fresh incursions into several Palestinian towns and neighborhoods. Our Ramallah correspondent Mona Kendu joined us earlier with more details.
Israeli forces stormed several areas across the occupied West Bank. Let's remind our viewer, on Tuesday, a Palestinian carried out a shooting, wounding two Israeli security officers. One of them was shot and wounded, and he was in serious condition. This happened near Gush Etzion, between Beit Lahem and Al Khalil. Today, the Israeli forces stormed these areas in Beit Lahem and in Al Khalil, and the Israelis have stormed as well Jenin, because the hometown of this Palestinian who carried out the shooting and was shot and killed is the Al-Hashimiyah town in Jenin. The Israelis stormed the Al-Hashimiyah town, stormed several cities, several towns and refugee camps around Jenin, and a number of Palestinians had been detained there. The Israeli forces also stormed Nablus, and they surrounded a house in one of the neighborhoods there. Clashes continued for several hours, according to statement from the resistance groups. And at the end of the day, one Palestinian was arrested. The Israeli military said that this Palestinian, originally from Jenin as well, he is a wanted Palestinian by the Israeli forces. The Israeli soldiers stormed Al Jalazon refugee camp near Ramallah, and a number of Palestinians had been detained. The Israeli forces also raided Jifna town near Bir Zeit, and a number of Palestinians had been arrested there. The exact number up till the moment is still unknown, but as every day we have been documenting the detentions by the Israeli forces.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has congratulated the Iranian nation on the Persian New Year. In a televised address to the nation, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei named the new year as surge in production through people's participation. Elaborating on this year's slogan, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "The growth in production will solve many of Iran's economic problems, including inflation and unemployment." That's why the leader added the issue of domestic production has been highlighted in New Year's slogans over the past years. Ayatollah Khamenei reviewed the previous Iranian calendar as well. The leader said the country saw an outstanding improvement in the scientific and technological domain over the past 12 months. He also pointed to some key events that Iranians witnessed at home, as well as those that occurred abroad. Ayatollah Khamenei said the most tragic of all those events was the one that took place in Gaza, a reference to the ongoing Israeli genocidal war on the besieged territory. Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi made a televised speech on the Persian New Year as well. He said his administration did not sacrifice the future of the country by focusing on minor issues. Raisi touched on the efforts his administration made to boost the country's economic and industrial growth. He wished a prosperous New Year and said his government will do its best to control inflation and increase industrial production. The Iranian president also highlighted other domestic issues and pledged that his administration will complete half-finished projects. He added the government will direct the available funds toward production and infrastructure. Well, Iranians are celebrating Nowruz around the country as the occasion coincides with the holy month of Ramadan. Celebrating Nowruz in Iran dates back to thousands of years ago and comes along with many customs to enter the new year with a totally fresh spirit. Families visit each other and sit around the hafsin table praying for a good year ahead. About 300 million people worldwide celebrate Nowruz with traditions and rituals that vary in each country. In 2009, the United Nations designated Nowruz as an international event at the initiative of several countries that share this event. This year, Muslims in these countries are also celebrating Ramadan, which gives a holy vibe to the New Year celebrations.
Nowruz, the beginning of the Persian New Year, has always given energy and hope to people celebrating the event to observe Iranian traditions and enter the new year with a totally fresh spirit. The arrival of Nowruz for Iranians is tantamount to shopping spree and finishing their undone work. Millions of Iranians embrace the turn of the Persian year and celebrate the spring festival with many ceremonial customs waiting to be observed.
Well, everybody is busy shopping. It is time of Nowruz and the new year. I have bought sabze, sweets and fruits. We're waiting for the new year to arrive.
Sofre Hafsin is unique, symbolic for the Nowruz festivity and its tradition. The Hafsin spread includes seven items, all starting with the letter Sin in the Persian alphabet. Iranians say there's a history behind each element, including serke, vinegar, symbolizes patience and immortality, sumac represents love and compassion, sib, apple, is a symbol of health and fertility, senjet, silverberry, is seen as a simulator of love and affection. Sabze, sprouts, symbolizes rebirth. Seed or garlic is a symbol of protection in the face of affliction. And samanu represents affluence. Nowruz is a unique opportunity for families and relatives to get together and visit each other. That is why Nowruz is regarded as a cultural bridge which unites people. This year, as Nowruz holidays coincide with the holy month of Ramadan, family members will most likely meet up after sunset or time of iftar when those who are fasting break their fast. Nowruz has begun and the Iranians are celebrating it as an ancient festivity to mark the first day of spring and the renewal of life and nature. This year, Nowruz has a different flavor to it as the Iranians are celebrating it with the holy month of Ramadan together, making it an exception. Fateh Masumi, Tehran.
That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
On behalf of myself and all of my... On behalf of myself and all of my... On behalf of myself and all of my... On behalf...
Ayahs, 30 days. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. A monotheist person not only reflects on the Noble Quran, but also tries to explain the ayahs of these heavenly scriptures to others and make them familiar with its teachings. Explicating of the Quranic teachings, first of all, was the duty of the Prophet and his infallible successors, every faithful too, according to the extent that they had learned from the Ahlul Bayt, embarked on this heavy duty. So, the ulema that are Muslim scholars took over this duty after the occultation of the 12th infallible successor of the Prophet, Imam Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance, and have seriously continued this job till the present day. Today, this duty has become highly important due to the broad assault of enemies against the beliefs of Islam and humanity. Today, in the 9th episode of the Ramadan special series, you will hear on a principle in Islam, which is very important for having a healthy society. This principle is enjoining what is good and forbidding what is evil. This topic will be explained with a focus on ayahs 163 to 166 of Surah A'raf. Stay tuned, please. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, said in his sermon on the final day of Sha'ban and the wake of Ramadan, "Whoever refrains from disturbing people in this month, Almighty Allah will keep his wrath away from him." In September 1988, in one of the Chicago subway stations, a woman was raped. She asked help from people, but the onlookers would pass by indifferently. Only a man cooperated with police to arrest the culprit. What is astounding in this event was the reaction of the passers-by and onlookers rather than the rape itself. Professor Michael Cook, British historian and lecturer of Princeton University, US, wrote after reading the story on newspaper, "After reading the issue, I thought, if we have any duty to prevent others from doing indecent act towards our fellow humans, is the behavior of others related to us? Michael reached to the conclusion that there is no name for this duty in the West, and the word help also fails to explain it. He notices in his studies that there are orders on this in one of the divine religions. These orders are called enjoining what is good and forbidding what is evil. Thus, Michael authored a book in 2000 titled Enjoining What is Good and Forbidding What is Evil in the Islamic Thought. Feeling responsibility towards others and society is a sign of growth and sublimity of society. An advanced society is not the one where technology is in a high level, but a society where individuals feel responsibility towards each other and are not indifferent to social problems. This is a living and dynamic society. The Noble Quran says that Luqman, the sage, told his son to bid others to do good deeds and prevents them from evil deeds. God explains one of the clear examples of this social principle in Surah A'raf. The Israelites were dispersed on land after entering Beit al-Muqaddas. A group of them decided to live along the coast of the Red Sea. Among the instructions of the Torah was to appoint Saturday as the holiday and the day of repose. The fishers of the region, however, noticed that fat and big fish would approach the coast on Saturdays. Did the fish realize the difference between Saturday and other weekdays? Or, it was God's command to test people. The fishers of Israelites thought of doing something to feign obedience of Allah's command while catching the best fish. Therefore, they built a small ponds along the coast with waterways leading to the sea. They would open the waterways on Saturday, and many fish would enter them. But when returning home in the evening, they would close the waterways and catch the fish on Sunday. On Sunday, they would say, God has ordered us not to fish, so we have not fished. We have just entrapped them in ponds. At first, they committed this sin with a religious justification. But little by little, the sin lost its ugliness in their eyes, and they dared to disrespect Saturday. Gradually, fishers engaged in fishing very brazenly and earned a lot of money. The Noble Quran says after this ignominious act in Ayah 163 of Surah A'raf, ask them about the town that was situated on the seaside. When they violated the Sabbath day visibly on the shore, but on days when they were not keeping Sabbath, they would not come to them. Thus, did we test them because of the transgressions they used to commit? A group of people decided to prevent them from this act. Yet, some others among the faithful preferred to keep silent, saying that there was no use in forbidding what is evil. They said, why do you advise a people whom Allah will destroy or punish with a severe punishment? The former group answered, as an excuse before your Lord, and with the hope that they may be God-wary. Now, the point to note here is that God says, on the fate of these groups, so when they forgot what they had been reminded of, we delivered those who forbade evil conduct and seized the wrongdoers with a terrible punishment because of the transgressions they used to commit. Dear listeners, here God says that only those who forbade evil deeds were saved and both those who committed evil deeds and those who were silent were punished. Enjoining what is good and forbidding what is evil have their roots in the Quran, the practice of the Prophet, and the wisdom. It is interesting that God mentions the name of two creatures which have enjoined what is good and forbidden what is evil. One is ant. In Surah Naml, we read that an ant said to other ants, "O ants, enter your dwellings, lest Solomon and hosts should trample you while you are unaware." The other creature is the hoopoe, which is the time of Prophet Solomon came to him and reported from the land of Sheba. The hoopoe said to Solomon that the people of Sheba were worshipping the sun instead of Allah. Thus, this report on the wrong deed of the people of Sheba led to their belief in God's religion after their queen came to Solomon and realized truth and the right path. An important example of enjoining what is good and forbidding what is evil are the officials, elites, and those who are called influencers in society. If they do something wrong, ordinary people will be affected and will do wrong acts more easily. Imam Ali, peace upon him, recommends people to advise their rulers. He knew that if this principle is not internalized on society, some will violate good deeds and promote evil ones, while no one protests them. This happened several decades later, when people kept silent against Yazid and his flagrant indecency. Ultimately, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, embarked on this great obligation and rose up against Yazid, which led to his martyrdom and the captivity of women and children from his family and relatives. Imam Hussein said among his companions, "O people, the Messenger of God said, whoever sees a wrongdoing ruler making God's haram as halal, opposing the breaching God's covenant, opposing the practice of God's apostle, treating God's servants oppressively, yet he does not oppose this ruler verbally or practically, it deserves for Allah to put him where he puts that ruler, in hell." Imam Hussein, peace upon him, said on the philosophy of his uprising, "I have risen up for enjoining what is good and forbidding what is evil and reforming my ancestors' ummah." Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, continued Imam Hussein's path when he staged the greatest revolution of the 20th century and the most effective movement during the age of laicism and atheism. His uprising was a clear example of enjoining what is good and forbidding what is evil. The world had gone astray when Imam Khomeini jolted conscience to wake up to stand against oppression and corruption. Like his ancestor, Imam Hussein, Imam Khomeini realized that the greatest evil is the corrupt and oppressive ruler who leads society in the wrong way.
نبي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge with Sheikh Mukhtar on IRIB English Radio.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of a guide for managers. We are basing our discussions on the 151st sermon of Nahjul Balagha, where Imam Ali alayhi salam warns about certain tests and calamities. And the actual reason behind these calamities is being too much engrossed and too much involved and overwhelmed by blessings, like to overly focus on them and just be drunken because of those blessings. And then he goes on to say that as a result of these, this state where a person is, kind of drunk in those blessings, he will not be able to protect himself, he will make some mistakes, okay, they'll not be careful, their foresight will reduce, and all of these difficulties that he mentions. Because of the mistakes, certain punishments might come, so be careful from first. Don't make those mistakes. وَتَثَبَّتُ فِي قَتَامِ الْعِشْوَةِ He says that be careful and be firm and steadfast and stick to the path when there are confusions that are facing you in the society, in the social dimension. This is also something that is important to keep in mind.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, Imam Ali alayhi salam, when he talks about this issue of confusion and to stay firm in the state of confusion, it's very important for us to be careful about this issue. Why do I say so? It's because many times these confusions come. And what do you do in this state? I'll give you a simple example. When you are, for example, driving, okay, sometimes it becomes very foggy, very foggy. And there's thick fog everywhere. In this situation, what you need to do is that you need to slow down a bit. And with the little visibility that you have, you stick to that path that you know definitely is correct. Isn't it? Like with that little visibility, even if it's 10 centimeters visibility or even let's say 40 centimeters of visibility, you can see the road ahead of you, isn't it? With that little visibility, you keep and stay focused and move slowly and surely in the direction. And as the road begins to turn, very slightly in within that 10 centimeters, you can notice that the road is going to a slight turn, and you can turn with the road. Or if there is any kind of impediment ahead, if you're going slowly and surely, you'll be able to see the impediment and stop in time. But if you decide not to focus on those issues that are firm, those that are clear, and get engrossed in other issues that are, you can say, that are branch issues, not the actual root issues, that are offshoots. If you start to focus on those offshoots, you will never be able to achieve your destination. So, for example, as you are driving, instead of focusing on the 10 centimeter visibility, you start to look ahead. If you start to look ahead, you will not be able to see anything. It's a fog. Once in a while, you'll see a light. So once in a while, the fog will open and you'll see something like a tree. But you don't know what it is. It's always confused. You might make some interpretations. Like you might say and interpret, no, there is the path goes ahead for another 10 meters and you start to speed up. You know, you can make a mistake. You can bang. You can cause accidents. But instead, if you focus on the path that you already know very clearly, you will be able to pass through the whole impediment and the whole detrimental situation very easily. If a person focuses on this example, this really summarizes the whole thing that Imam Ali alayhi salam is trying to tell us here. Allahumma salli ala
Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Nahjul Balagha, translated as the Peak of Eloquence, is a compilation of sermons, letters, and sayings that reflected Imam Ali's profound insights on governance, ethics, spirituality, and social justice. Sayyid Razi's meticulous work in preserving and presenting Imam Ali's words has made Nahjul Balagha a timeless source of inspiration for scholars, theologians, and seekers of wisdom.
Now, adding on to that, now, if you look at the statement of Imam Ali Islam, it has a similarity to what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in the Holy Quran, where he says, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم والذي أنزل عليك الكتاب منه آيات محكمات. He is the one who revealed the book. From amongst the verses, there are verses that are muhkam, that are firm, that are clear in their indication. They are the mother of the book. They are the core or the main part of the book. Hunna ummul kitab wa ukharu mutashabihat. And there are others that are mutashabih. Other verses are their indication or their signification is not clear, right? فَأَمَّا الَّذِينَ فِي قُلُوبِهِمْ زَيْغٌ. Those whose hearts have a deviation, فَيَتَّبِعُونَ مَا تَشَابَهَ مِنْهُ. They follow those confusing elements of the book. Those books, those elements that are not very clear, those meanings that are not completely clear, and they follow the ambiguities. That means in that ambiguous situation, you can interpret what you want and decide to do what you feel is correct. Those who have deviations in their heart, they do that. ابْتِغَاء الْفِتْنَةِ وَابْتِغَاء التَّأْوِيلِ. Why do they do this? Because they want to cause fitna, they want to cause confusion, they want to cause problems. وَابْتِغَاءَ تَأْوِيلِ. And they are looking for making different types of interpretations to fit their whims. وَمَا يَعْلَمُ تَأْوِيلَهُ إِلَّا اللَّهُ وَالرَّاسِخُونَ فِي الْعِلْمِ. Only those that, only Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala knows their meanings, and the رَاسِخُونَ فِي الْعِلْمِ, those that are firm in their knowledge. Now, here see, when we are told about the muhkam verses and the mutashabih verses, or the ambiguous verses and the clear verses, whenever you are confused about the ambiguous verses, you need to refer and revert them back to the firm verses and the clear verses. If you refer them back to the clear verses, the indication that those confusing verses or those verses that are a little bit, their indication is not clear, will become clear under the light of those clear verses. Inshallah, we shall delve on this discussion in the near future. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar in the program Gate of Knowledge on RIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من نداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال منه هو في الشدائد مجيد والفضل يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring
event.
In Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, I'm Gisa Misha Ahmadi and The Spotlight. Israel's restrictions on humanitarian aid for the Gaza Strip may amount to a war crime. Now, those are the words of the UN Human Rights Chief. This, as the European Union's top diplomat also on Monday accused Israel of using starvation as a weapon of war by preventing humanitarian aid from reaching Gaza. Now, in this edition, we will be discussing what this actually means from a humanitarian point of view to a legal issue. And in order to do that, I am joined by Daniel Yagich, who is joining us from Beirut, and also Paul Larudi, co-founder of the Free Palestine Movement, joining us live from Berkeley. Let's begin with our guest from Beirut, Mr. Yagich. The Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, the IPC report, released on Monday, says that malnutrition and food shortages have probably exceeded famine levels in northern Gaza. What do we mean by exceeding famine levels? Because I believe for us and most of our viewers, famine itself is the extreme.
I mean, it is catastrophic to even think about what a situation in Gaza must be like now, 6 months into this genocide. And of course, we need to keep in mind that in addition to what the Israeli regime has been conducting for the past half a year and using starvation now as a method of war, the context before October 7th was awful in Gaza as well. I mean, the UN and human rights organizations have in a previous decade warned that Gaza would be uninhabitable at the beginning of this decade. So the current Israeli genocide, of course, adds even more to a situation in which the population had already been under a siege for many years and under a blockade. And it's very difficult to imagine what the outcome of all of this will be, because starvation now is added as an additional form of warfare, in addition to the bombings and killings of Palestinians in so many different ways, as we have seen being live streamed actually by the perpetrator, the Israeli regime, for the past half a year.
Okay, let's bring in Mr. Paul Laduri. Mr. Laduri, we've been hearing the word "may" too often. This may be considered a war crime, it may be considered a genocide. Why are officials refraining from clearly stating that using food and starvation as a weapon against Palestinians is a war crime, and what Israelis are doing there is a genocide?
Well, diplomats and UN officials are always overly cautious. They want to wait until something like the International Court of Justice or the ICC or some official body declares that this is in fact the case. They defer to other authorities to verify what they say in cautious terms publicly. But the fact is, everybody knows this. In fact, the Israelis have not been hiding it at all. Their public officials have been advocating the use of disease exposure, that is, exposure to the elements by destroying the homes of Palestinians, and starvation, and the lack of clean water, drinking water, potable water, as means of eliminating the Palestinians. They specifically have said openly and publicly that their intention is to eliminate the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. So this is hardly a secret, and it matters little what the United Nations officials say to it. It's happening first in the north of Gaza, where delivery of aid is at its least extent, and where they are eating grass and whatever they can manage, animal feed. We know all the stories. But this is intentional. The Israeli military has been destroying markets and warehouses full of food. They have been bombing the farms and the animals and everything. Their intention, and why are they doing that? Why are they doing this? It's because when they shoot somebody or bomb somebody, they are blamed for killing them. When they starve them to death, they haven't actually touched them, have they? But their intention is, and if they have the means, within months or however long it takes, they will starve people to death. And in fact, as we know, children especially and the elderly and others have actually starved to death. This was predicted, and it's happening.
You're absolutely right. And the fact that it is being done intentionally, let's move back to our guest in Beirut. Well, we do know that the ICJ issued a provisional ruling stating that humanitarian aid needs to get to the people in Gaza immediately. And that provisional ruling was issued only because it was supposed to be implemented immediately, which the Israelis completely overlooked. And that itself obviously requires a ceasefire because you can't send humanitarian aid under constant bombardment. So does this leave any room to doubt Israel's intentions as using food insecurity as a weapon against Gazans?
There is absolutely no doubt. The Israelis have been very transparent in both their goals and in the ways in which they want to achieve them. And this has been very well documented. The Israeli regime, for the past weeks and months, has openly bragged about their genocidal intentions and very clearly made clear that they want to remove Palestinians from Gaza through policies of ethnic cleansing and genocide. So this is very clear. What is happening, what we see more on the political and media discourse, is that in particular the Western political and media elites, including we have to mention the European Union, are investing crucial efforts in providing propaganda on behalf of the Israeli regime, and to basically, to some extent, even in the use of language, conceal this very transparent communication that the Israelis are actually providing for the entire world to see. So there's absolutely no doubt about what the Israelis are intending to do. And also here, if we look at the broader historical context, this is a settler colony that only works under the framework of apartheid, and the movement or the ideology of Zionism on which this was founded is inherently anti-indigenous. It's a colonial movement with the idea that Palestine should be settled by the settlers and it's not the land of the indigenous people. In fact, if we go back to the early writings of Zionism, Palestine is fantasized as, I'm quoting here, a land without a people for a people without a land, and so on. So the genocidal intent is very clear in at least the political discourse by the Israeli regime, but much more so stretches throughout decades of Zionism, and what we see now should not be a surprise, nor should there be any doubt about the intentions of the Israeli regime.
Now that the intentions are obviously very clear, Mr. Larudi, and I'm sorry if I mispronounced your name at first, Mr. Larudi, we are using some words that previously we would see them in historical texts and referring to a very serious crimes to be pursued in international courts. We are using the word war crime. We are using ethnic cleansing. We're using genocide. What is the legal aspect to this matter, and how far should the Israelis go before we can see actually a court ruling to stop this?
Well, they've seen a court ruling to stop this. The World Court has judged on this. But the problem is that there's very little in the way of enforcement. And in fact, the Genocide Convention does not, the only enforcement under the Genocide Convention is that all the signatories of the Genocide Convention, meaning 153 of them, one of whom is Israel, they are bound to do everything possible not to avoid supporting the genocide, meaning the removal of all arms deliveries and other types of services to the one that's committing the genocide or who is committing what can be called genocidal actions, since legally speaking, the World Court won't even determine that genocide takes place until after it's happened. But nevertheless, they can issue an injunction, as they have, against anything that can be considered a genocidal action. Now, that's the only thing. And you have, unfortunately, a minority of countries that are directly enabling the genocide. Most importantly, the United States sending mountains, just unlimited arms with which Israel can bombard the civilian population of Gaza unrelentingly and eliminate the population one way or another, either by expelling them somehow, although there are not any willing cooperating countries, not Egypt and not the others. But otherwise, they're not going to step back from the possibility that they might annihilate the all or most of the population of Gaza. That's not off the table.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Mr. Gegic, if you could please tell us, what are the measures that we can take to force the Israeli entity to comply?
That is a very good question, and I fear there is currently no international mechanism or institution that is able or ready to hold the Israeli regime accountable, simply because if we can ask the question, who would be able to do that? And it's at this point, of course, the United States, which could put an end to this genocide very easily today. But not only is the United States not willing to end the Israeli atrocities, it is even more complicit and it is enabling this war against Palestinians. So at the end of the day, Palestinians are victims of a genocide that is being carried out by the United States and by parts of the Western world against a defenseless population which is trapped in an extermination camp that Gaza has become. And then if we look at the International Court of Justice, the United Nations, I mean, the hegemony that the United States still holds over much of the world also enables the Israeli regime to stand above international law and to get away with these atrocities and crimes while the rest of the world is able to watch them live on television. So it is very much this power imbalance of power that makes it very, at this point, as we see, impossible for any broader intervention. And at the same time, we need to keep in mind the majority of the world belongs to the global south, to the third world, and even in the UN and the General Assembly, there's a very clear majority in support of a ceasefire, in support of Palestinian human rights. But none of this can be enforced under the current the system currently the so-called international community is depending on.
So let's go back to Mr. Laroudi. Are there any ways to enforce these court rulings, the ones issued by the ICC and the ICJ? Because